thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese, and I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Bart Strummer. Bart is professor of philosophy at the University of Groningen. He works in the area of moral philosophy known as metaethics. Metaethics addresses broad questions about the nature of moral theorizing itself. His new book is titled Unbelievable Errors, An Error Theory About All Normative Judgments. It's published with Oxford University Press. Now, it's intuitive to think that statements of the form, lying is wrong, ascribe a property, namely that of wrongness, to acts of the type lying. In this way, one might think that statements of this kind are a lot like statements of the form, Bill is left-handed. This statement also seems to ascribe a property, left-handedness, to Bill. But what about statements like, Bill is a Wookiee? There is no property of being a Wookiee, and the statement therefore seems to be false. Now, what's called the error theory is the view that moral statements of the kind that attribute moral properties are always false, because no such properties exist. In a fabulous new book, Bart offers a novel kind of defense of the error theory as it applies to all normative judgments. Now, the character of this defense is fascinating. Bart argues that the error theory cannot be believed, and this unbelievability counts in favor of the theory. Now, that's a heavy thought, and so there's a lot to talk about. But let's start by greeting our guest. Hi, Bart.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Philosophy.
Well, thank you.
Well, we usually start with the author, so we won't make an exception in this episode. So why don't you kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I teach philosophy at the University of Groningen, as you just said. And Groningen is a small university town in the north of the Netherlands, and it's quite close to where I grew up. I also grew up in the north of the Netherlands, and I actually was an undergraduate here in Groningen as well. And I came to philosophy in a kind of roundabout way, I suppose. So as an undergraduate, I initially did economics. I studied economics. But I wasn't enjoying that very much, and I wanted to do something else. And I'd always been very interested in politics. But Groningen didn't have a politics department. So I looked around a little bit, and I found that there was a fairly prominent Dutch political theorist who was a professor in the philosophy department in Groningen. And that's how I ended up doing philosophy. So I initially just wanted to do political philosophy because of this interest in politics. But then I found that the things in philosophy I was most interested in were more foundational questions. So, for example, in political philosophy, there's a lot of disagreement. So political philosophers disagree about justice. So Rawls might say that justice requires this, and Nozick might say that justice requires something else. And the sorts of questions I was interested in were like, you know, in cases of disagreement like that, is one of them really right? And mm-hmm. and what would it be for a judgment about justice to really be right or correct or true or something like that? What could make it true or correct? So I found pretty quickly that those were the questions I was most interested in, and those are the questions, as you just said, that metaethics deals with. So that's how I ended up in the area of philosophy that's known as metaethics. And so after completing the philosophy degree in Groningen, I went to the UK and I did a PhD at the University of Reading. And I stayed in the UK for a total of 15 years, and a few years ago I came back to Groningen to teach here.
Wonderful. Can I ask just a question about metaethics very broadly?
Sure.
So again, I'm an outsider to this particular subfield within philosophy, but it does seem to me like it's had a pretty striking renaissance maybe in the past 10 years or so. Am I right to think that?
I think that's right. Yeah, maybe the last 20 years or so. But yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about what
accounts? It's a very lively area.
What do you have any idea? What do you think accounts for that?
That's hard to say, actually.
Okay.
I mean,
that's okay.
I guess it's a combination of, people starting to defend very sophisticated versions of expressivism. And, on one side, and then on the other side, people, defending new versions of non-naturalism and other traditional positions in metaethics. And there's just been a lot of lively debate in the last 20 years or so.
It seems to me, again, just I was a graduate student in the 90s, and there wasn't a lot of metaethics that was being offered as sort of coursework at that time, and it always sort of struck me as odd that now it's just it seems like it's all over the journals. The book is about is a kind of defense of the error theory, which I'm sure many but not all of our listeners will be familiar with. So maybe one place to begin, though, in getting into the core of your book is to just talk in the broader sense about what it is to call a theory an error theory, or what the error theory is. Maybe you can start us off with a quick summary and maybe talk a little bit about Mackey and that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure. So the error theory was first defended by a philosopher called John Mackey in a book entitled Ethics Inventing Right and Wrong. And he first defended it in a journal article in the 1940s, I think, but it really took off in the 1970s when he wrote this book about ethics. And the error theory really consists of two parts. So the first part of the theory is a view that's known as cognitivism in metaethics. And cognitivism says that moral judgments are beliefs in the sense that they're mental states that represent the world as being a certain way. And they do that by ascribing a property to something in the world. So, for example, the judgment that lying is wrong is a belief that represents lying as being a certain way. And it does that by ascribing a property to lying, namely the property of being wrong. So it says that lying has a certain feature, you might say, and that feature is the feature of being wrong. So that's one part of the view. That's what it says about what moral judgments are. But then what's distinctive about the error theory is that it denies that properties like wrongness exist. So it says moral judgments ascribe properties like wrongness and rightness and goodness and badness, but those properties don't actually exist. And as you said in the introduction, if you ascribe a property to something in the world and the property doesn't exist, then you're ascribing a property to something that doesn't have the property. And if you're ascribing a property to something that the thing doesn't have, then what you're saying is false. So the conclusion that Mackey drew from this is that all moral judgments are false. So that's the theory that he was defending. And
Please continue. Yeah.
Yeah. So in Ethics Inventing Right and Wrong, he gave two main arguments for the error theory. The first argument is an argument that's known as the argument from queerness, and the second argument is known as the argument from relativity. The argument from queerness says that if there was a property of wrongness, then it would be a property that is utterly different from any other property that we know. And it's a little bit unclear how exactly Mackey thinks that the property would have to be different. He says some things that suggest that the property would have to be sort of intrinsically motivational. So anybody who's aware of the property of wrongness would be motivated not to do things that are wrong. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation of what Mackey's saying, which perhaps makes it more plausible, would be to say that the property of wrongness is normative. It sort of tells us what to do, you might say. And in that respect, it's unlike any other property we know. And then Mackey says, well, given that properties like rightness and wrongness are unlike any other property we know, there is a strong reason to suppose that that property doesn't exist. And that's what, and that what's actually going on here is that we're just projecting something onto the world that isn't really there. So that's the argument from queerness. And then Mackie also had another argument, the argument from relativity. And the argument from relativity says, just look around you at the different moral judgments that people make, and especially the moral judgments that people might make in other cultures, which might be very, very different from the judgments that we make in Western liberal democracies. And then Mackie says, well, what is the best explanation of why there are such differences between the judgments that people make in different cultures? Is it that one culture has detected the moral properties as they really are and the other culture is just mistaken? Or is it rather that there are maybe sociological differences between these cultures? There are historical differences between these cultures. People have been socialized in different ways. They read different newspapers. Their society works in different ways. Is that perhaps the best explanation of why they make different moral judgments? And then Mackie says, well, clearly the second explanation is the better explanation, at least according to him. And he thinks that that's another reason to think that moral properties don't exist, because that explanation doesn't actually appeal to the existence of moral properties. It just appeals to the culture that people find themselves in.
Right. And I take it, though, that one of the, at least for some, one of the surprising upshots of the view as Mackie understood it is that Mackie thinks that the adopting the error theory has very little impact on our first order moral judgments.
That's right. Yeah. So he defends the theory in the first chapter of the book, and then in the second chapter and the later chapters of the book, he goes on to make various claims about morality. So there is a kind of tension there, I guess. I guess Mackie saw himself as maybe putting forward a more modest kind of morality that we're just sort of constructing together, rather than the realist kind of morality that he's attacking. But there's definitely a tension there. So I don't think there's anybody who defends the error theory but who has completely stopped making moral judgments. It just Right. seems that would be a very, very difficult thing to do, and certainly something that Mackie didn't stop doing. And I don't know any other error theorist who really stopped doing that.
Right, great. So let's turn now to your book, and we'll have to come back a little bit later in the conversation to that sort of upshot about how we if we adopt the error theory, what happens?
Yeah, sure.
Because you've got views on that as well. But so let's turn to your book, Unbelievable Errors. Now, as you were just describing, it seems like the first item on the to-do list for the error theorist is to give reasons why one should deny the existence of the properties or the features that are referenced in the discourse about which one is proposing an error theory.
Yeah.
And so your book offers arguments against two pretty prominent kinds of realism about moral properties. Again, many of our listeners will be familiar with this kind of distinction. There are realists who are reductive realists, and then there are realists who are non-reductive realists, and you think that both forms of these realist doctrine can be defeated. Can you run us through maybe start with the non-reductive realist? Can you run us through this is, I know in the book it's very precise and admirably precise, but maybe you can just sort of give us a good thumbnail of your argument against non-reductive realism.
Yeah, sure. So maybe I should step back a little bit and say something a bit more general about
Sure.
the structure of the first part of the book. So the main thing I do in sort of the first half of the book, I suppose, is defend the error theory by attacking all the alternatives to the error theory. And the reason why I do it like that is that the error theory is just a very, very unattractive view, right? So it says all of our moral judgments are false. And the view I defend is even broader. So it says all normative judgments are false, including including judgments about reasons for belief and reasons for action, that is really a super unattractive view. So the only way to defend a view like that, I think, is to look at the whole field of metaethics, look at all the competitors to the error theory, and try to rule them out one by one. And then once you've done that, you've ended up with an argument for the error theory, I think. And so, as you say, one of the alternatives is realism, and there are two kinds of realism. So one version is a non-reductive view, and the other version is a reductive view. And I define those views in a specific way. So I say the non-reductive realism is the view that normative properties exist and that they're different from what I call descriptive properties. And descriptive properties are properties that can be ascribed so that you can say that something has using only descriptive language. So non-reductive realism says that normative properties cannot be ascribed using only descriptive language, in other words. And reductive realism, which is the other kind of realism, says that normative properties are identical to descriptive properties, and that means that we could, at least in principle, ascribe normative properties using only descriptive, non-normative language. Okay, and so then what I do is I argue against each of those two forms of realism. And what I say against non-reductive realism is that if we take properties to be in the world, part of the world, rather than just meanings of words, then I think we have to say that whenever two predicates, so predicates are bits of language that ascribe a property. So, for example, the predicate is wrong, just the word is wrong. Those words ascribe the property of wrongness. Mm-hmm. I say that if we take properties to be in the world rather than just meanings of predicates, then we have to say that necessarily coextensive predicates, so that means predicates that apply to the same things in all possible worlds, so that necessarily apply to the same things, that necessarily coextensive predicates ascribe a single property. So whenever two predicates are necessarily coextensive, they ascribe a single property. And then I argue that for every normative predicate, so for every predicate like is wrong, is right, is a reason, is good, is bad, and so on, for every normative predicate, we can construct a descriptive predicate that is necessarily coextensive with that normative predicate. And so then it follows that if there are normative properties, they must be identical to descriptive properties, because for every normative predicate, we can construct a descriptive predicate that ascribes the same property as that normative predicate. And that means that if there are normative properties, then they must be identical to descriptive properties.
I see. So would it be right to say that the engagement in the first part of the book, at least the part of the book that deals with these realist theses, sort of is like a domino argument, right? It's to sort of say, look, the non-reductive version of the realist view, if you're going to be a realist, you've got to be a reductive realist. Because there's and then you have a separate argument against the reductive realist. Is that right?
That's right.
Good. Yeah. So if we're going to be realists, then it looks as if this point about coextensional normative and descriptive predicates should push us into a reductive form of realism, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Why shouldn't we be reductive realists then?
Okay, so that's the other part of the argument against realism. So then I say, look, okay, so what we've established now is that if there are normative properties, then they must be identical to descriptive properties. And then I say, if normative properties are identical to descriptive properties, then what that really means is that normative predicates ascribe descriptive properties. And then it seems that there must be something that makes it the case that a certain normative predicate ascribes a certain descriptive property, right? So you might say the predicate is wrong ascribes this descriptive property, or it describes that descriptive property, or it describes yet another descriptive property. And we want to know something about what makes it the case that it's this particular descriptive property that is ascribed by a given normative predicate. So it seems like that can't just be a brute fact. There must be something that makes that the case. And then the general structure of the argument is that I say, well, there are two kinds of things that could make that the case, that a certain normative predicate describes a certain descriptive property. What makes that the case might be something normative, something about how we should use normative predicates, for example. But then I say, well, if we say that, if we're reductive realist and we say that, then we end up in a kind of regress, because then we're appealing to something normative to explain what makes it the case that a normative predicate describes a descriptive property. And then we have to apply our reductive realism to that normative thing as well. And then if we again appeal to something normative, then we end up in a kind of regress. So that's one thing we can say. And that doesn't seem to work. So then it seems that what we should say, if we're reductive realist, is that what makes it the case that a certain descriptive property is described by a certain normative predicate is something descriptive. Maybe something about how we would use normative predicates if we had talked about it for a long time and had maximum descriptive information or something like that. But at any rate, we should say something descriptive. And then I argue in the book that if the reductive realist says that, then the view ends up entailing that there are certain descriptively specified conditions in which our normative judgments are guaranteed to be correct, right? So if you say, for example, what makes it the case that the predicate is wrong ascribes this particular descriptive property is that we would use the predicate is wrong in a certain way if we had full descriptive information, then it would follow that having full descriptive information would guarantee that your normative judgments are correct. And then I say, well, that is actually false. It doesn't seem to be true that there are any descriptively specified conditions that would guarantee that our normative judgments are correct. It's always possible to imagine somebody who is in those descriptively specified conditions and who would make normative judgments that we would say are actually incorrect rather than correct. And so then, if that's true, then it follows that if there are normative properties, they're not identical to descriptive properties. So then we have two parts of the argument against realism. The argument against non-reductive realism established that if there are normative properties, they are identical to descriptive properties. And the argument against reductive realism establishes that if there are normative properties, they're not identical to descriptive properties. And it seems that the only way in which those two claims can both be true is if their antecedent is false and if there are no normative properties. That seems to be the only way in which both of those claims can be true. And of course, if there are no normative properties, then it follows that realism in general about normative properties is false.
Right. Fantastic. One of the real virtues of the book, I think, is how, as you just even described it, how transparent the mode of the argument is at every moment. So that's wonderful. Let me just a quick call for some a little bit more detail. So, if part of the argument against the reductive realist is this sort of regress worry, I tend to be suspicious of claims that there are such things as virtuous circles and non-vicious regresses. But nonetheless, can you say something about why this particular regress is a problem? What would you say to somebody who said, well, okay, I understand that there's a regress looming, but maybe it's not a vicious regress, or maybe it's not a regress that we need to strive to avoid?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's a vicious regress because, the way I do it in the book is a little bit more complicated than how I just explained it to you. Sure. But the basic point is that it's the kind of regress where the truth of the first claim, so the claim at the end of the regress, is determined by the truth of the claim that's at the very end of so we start with a claim and then we work back and we have to keep working back. And I think a regress is not vicious if the truth of the claim that we start with determines the truth of the claim that we work back to. But in this case, it's the kind of regress where the truth of the claim that we start with depends on whether the claim at the very end of the regress is true or false.
Right.
And since it's an infinite regress, there is no claim at the end of the regress. So that means that the claim that we started with, whether that's true or false, is indeterminate.
Yeah, it's
kind of very abstract. But
yes, but yeah. I thought that was a really interesting argument. I have a colleague who's an infinitist about epistemic justification that I'm planning to have a conversation with very quickly, very soon after this interview, about this particular concern about this sort of, you might say, the direction of the support chain in the regress that I think is really very interesting. So So let's regroup then. So the main competitor to competitor to the error theory are realist views. The error theory has to establish that they're false. Yet there are some more contemporary meta-ethical positions, some of which you canvass in the book, that like the error theory, avoid realism or strive to avoid realism, and like the error theory, uphold cognitivism. So they think that there can be true and false. They think that there are truth values from all judgments, let's say, but yet reject the error theory because they hold that some moral judgments are in fact true. So can you tell us about a few of these? Some of them are expressivist or quasi-realist. Can you tell us about some of these non-realist cognitivisms that are not error theories, and why you think ultimately they don't work?
Right. Okay. So maybe I should start then by saying something about non-cognitivism.
Sure.
So the way I divide it up is there's realism. That's one main competitor, and then there are these two kinds that we just talked about. And then the other main competitor is the view that I call non-cognitivism in the book. And so the non-cognitivist is someone who thinks that normative judgments are not beliefs, so they're not mental states that represent the world, but they're instead mental states of some other kind. So maybe they're attitudes of approval or disapproval, or they're a certain kind of plan or something. And my argument against non-cognitivism starts from the idea that when two people make conflicting normative judgments, so they have conflicting thoughts about what's right or wrong or good or bad, then normally we think that at most one of these judgments is correct. So we think that it can't be the case that both of these judgments are correct. And then I look at various ways in which non-cognitivism can accommodate the thought that when we think that that when two people make conflicting normative judgments, we think that at most one of these judgments is correct. And there are various ways of doing it. So and I guess quasi-realism offers various. So quasi-realism is a kind of non-cognitivism or expressivism that tries to mimic certain claims that realists make, or that tries to get the advantages of realism without the disadvantages, you might say. And so quasi-realists have offered various strategies to accommodate claims like that. And I go through all the ones that I know about, and I argue that none of them really work. And I think the reason why none of them really works is that they all end up being sort of, you might say, symmetrical in a certain way. So, for example, one way of doing it would be to say, well, the thought that when two people make conflicting normative judgments, at most one of them is correct, is maybe a certain higher order disapproval. So it's maybe disapproval of two people having conflicting attitudes of approval and disapproval, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that is that if you say that, two people who have a normative disagreement might both they have conflicting attitudes of approval or disapproval if this version of non-cognitivism is true, and they might also have They might both have the same or similar higher order attitudes of disapproval. And on top of that, they might also have different third order, they might have third order attitudes of disapproval and so on. But the whole situation is kind of symmetrical. So you're just piling attitudes on top of attitudes, you might say. And there isn't really anything outside of those people's attitudes that breaks the deadlock and that makes it the case that at most one of them can really be right, that at most one of their conflicting judgments is really correct. So that's kind of the intuitive basis of the case that I make against non-cognitivism. So in the book it's a little bit more complicated, but sure. that's an intuitive feel for the way that I try to argue against non-cognitivism. Okay, so I take it that sort of exhausts the main options in metaethics. So there are these two kinds of realism and there's non-cognitivism. And then there are certain further views that people have defended in metaethics. But I think my arguments against the two kinds of realism and against non-cognitivism can be employed against those other views as well. So as you say, there are also people who are cognitivists, but who think that they can do without the sort of metaphysical baggage that realists do with, but without denying that certain moral judgments are true. So they want to deny, in a certain sense, that there are moral properties. But unlike the error theorist and their cognitivists, so they think that moral judgments are mental states that represent the world as being a certain way, so that do ascribe properties, presumably. But they also want to say that there are certain moral judgments that are nevertheless true. And I think that with those other views, a lot depends on the details of what exactly they say. But I think that once the details are spelled out in sufficiently, then it turns out that one of the arguments that I give against the other views will apply to those sorts of views as well.
Yeah, and I appreciated in the discussion of some of these, and I think it's fair to call them sort of strange hybrid views. Right, that a lot of them have or embrace a commitment that's sometimes just called quietism,
right?
Which I take it that when somebody says, "Well, at this point, my theory goes quietist," that is a kind of sort of helping yourself, using a word to get you something that you can't earn with, what Russell would have called honest philosophical labor.
Yeah.
So it seems
I think it's fair to say that no one ever calls themselves a quietist, right? So quietism is you can call somebody else's position quietist, but people who have that sort of view don't like to call themselves quietist, maybe for that reason.
Yeah.
But I take it, I have to say, I find it very hard to get a good handle on what exactly quietists are saying. But I think one way to get a handle on it is to see them as asserting that there are normative truths, but denying that there are normative properties in a sort of metaphysically heavy sense. So denying that there are moral properties that are really out there in the world in a certain sense. So in that sense, they're not realists, but they nevertheless think that there are normative truths that in some sense don't depend on our attitudes, presumably.
Right. It's a puzzling view.
Yeah. And I think that, the way to respond to that view is to ask them to say more about what those truths are and how they can be mind independent if they don't, because the form of the truths is presumably that they apply normative predicates to certain objects, and it seems that if this is all mind independent, the predicates would have to apply in virtue of something about the objects that satisfy the predicates, and then it starts to look like there should be a property out there in the world. So that's one way to push them. Another way to push them would be to say, well, look, if it's really true that there are no normative properties out there in the world, but nevertheless there are normative truths, then you just have to deny that moral judgments represent represent the world as being a certain way, because if they did, then they would be ascribing those metaphysically heavy properties. And then if they really do deny that that moral judgments represent the world as being a certain way, if they deny that, then they really become kind of non-cognitivists. And then my arguments against non-cognitivism would also apply to at least that version of quietism.
Sure. So let's now turn to some of the positive proposals, your own development of the error theory, because as we've already said, your book defends the error theory not just for a subclass of judgments, normative judgments. It's all normative judgments. Why should we think that, in your view, why should we think that the error theory applies to all normative judgments?
Well, I think that's just because the arguments that I give against the other views are arguments against those views applied to all normative judgments and all normative properties. So I guess there's a difference here between the arguments that Mackey gives and that that other error theorists like Richard Joyce give, because those arguments are really focused more just on moral judgments and moral properties. So it seems important to those arguments that they're focused on, and it's very clear in the case of Richard Joyce, for example, that they're focused on the idea that moral judgments imply that there are reasons for you to do something, whether you want to do those things or not. And that seems to mean that moral judgments are categorical in a certain way. So they're true of you independently of what your desires happen to be. So if your arguments for the error theory latch on to that feature of certain normative judgments, that they're categorical and independent of what your desires happen to be and so on, then your error theory is going to be more limited. Then it's only going to apply to those categorical normative judgments. And a lot of philosophers would say, well, those categorical normative judgments are mainly moral judgments. But I think that the arguments I give against the alternatives to the error theory don't really rely on the idea that the judgments that I'm talking about have to be categorical. So I think the arguments also apply to instrumental normative judgments. So normative judgments to the fact that if you have a certain desire, then you have a reason to do a certain thing.
Right. So, and I take it that, so when we say that they apply to all normative judgments, let's just make sure that everyone in the audience understands what that covers. So that's not just judgments that, you know, lying is wrong, but also judgments of the kind you were just saying that, you know, prudential, you know, if you want to achieve a particular end here, you know, you ought to, you know, you ought to take this medicine if you want to cure this disease. And also just I take it that also the relation of or the relation of being a reason for is also one of the properties that we should be error theorists about, on your view?
That's right. Yeah. So I think that, you know, that it's a relation, but it faces exactly the same arguments as normative properties. So just the mere fact that it's a relation doesn't really mean that the arguments don't apply. Sure. So the error theory I defend applies to moral judgments. It also applies to judgments about reasons for action, including instrumental reasons for action. It also applies to reasons for belief. And it may also apply to judgments about rationality, but that depends a little bit on what we mean by rationality. So I think, you know, we might use the word rationality and not mean anything normative, but if we do, then it also applies to that.
Okay, so the real sort of at least for me the most intriguing feature of your version of the error theory then has to do with the extension of the error theoretic analysis to reasons for belief, because one of the features of your version of the error theory is that if the error theory is true, it's unbelievable.
Yep.
Okay, you have to say more about that. That's a really intriguing thought.
Yeah, so maybe I should start by saying something autobiographical about this. So
great.
So when I started seriously thinking about metaethics, I was really impressed by the arguments against realism. And initially I started out as a kind of non-naturalist realist or a kind of non-reductive realist. But after a while, I started to think there are really good arguments against this position. And I also thought there were really good arguments against reductive realism. And there were really good arguments against non-cognitivism. And so when I considered each argument individually, I thought, you know, that's a good argument, refutes the position, I thought. And of course, I realized that if that was so, then really the position in metaethics that these arguments were supporting was an error theory, and a very general error theory. So an error theory about all normative judgments. But I just sort of found that I couldn't really convince myself that an error theory about all normative judgments was really true. So that's sort of, I took it that that was kind of first personal evidence that at least I wasn't able to believe this error theory about all normative judgments, because I had considered the arguments very carefully and I just found that I didn't form a belief in the theory that I thought they seemed to show was true. And so that sort of led me to think that maybe it's just the case that we can't really believe the error. Maybe it's not just me, but maybe it's in general true that we can't actually, that none of us can actually believe the error theory. But obviously that's only first personal evidence. So what I want to do in the book is offer a more general argument, which is a more general argument for the claim that we cannot believe the error theory, which, if it works, also explains why we are unable to believe this very general error theory about all normative judgments. And so the argument or explanation that I give starts from the idea that we can't have a belief and at the same time think that there is absolutely no reason for the belief. So that doesn't mean that in order to have a belief, we have to explicitly think that there is a reason for the belief. We don't need to have thoughts like that. And it also doesn't mean that we have to know what the reason is for the belief, because very often we don't know what the reason is for the belief. But the thought that I start with is that if you believe something, you can't at the same time explicitly think that there is absolutely no reason to think that thing that you believe. There is absolutely no reason to believe the thing that you believe. Because the thought is, well, if you do start to believe that there is absolutely no reason for the belief, then the belief will just disappear. If you think there's no reason for the belief and you have that thought consciously and explicitly, then the belief will disappear. So I start by defending that claim, the claim that we can't have a belief and at the same time think that there's no reason for the belief. Okay, and then I say, well, an error theory that applies to all normative judgments also applies to judgments about reasons for belief. And so the theory says that there are no reasons for belief, right? So it denies that the property of being a reason for belief exists, or the relation of being a reason for belief, it denies that that exists. So in other words, it says that there are no reasons for belief. And then it seems that in order to really believe the error theory, so to be very confident that the error theory is true while having an adequate understanding of what the theory says, we would then have to believe that there are no reasons for belief, and we would therefore have to believe that there is no reason to believe the error theory. So in other words, if all of this is right, then in order to really believe the error theory, we would have to believe that there is no reason to believe the error theory. But that's the thing that I think we can't do, right? So if we can't have a belief and at the same time explicitly think that there's no reason for the belief, and if doing that is the only way to really believe the error theory, then it follows that we can't believe the error theory.
Now, so good. Maybe though, just a little bit of further detail, because you do think that it's this kind of argument that you've just sketched works most clearly in the case of what we might call full belief.
Right.
So can you say something? Because you do say in the book, like, we can come close to believing the error theory. Maybe we can come partially to believe it.
Yeah.
Can you say something about why that's a crucial feature of of the unbelievability thesis.
Yeah, so I should say two things about this, actually. So one thing I should say is that I am using the term belief in a particular sense. So there are other senses of the term belief in which we maybe can believe the error theory. But I use the term belief to mean having a high degree of confidence that something is true, and adequately understanding the thing that you have a high degree of confidence in. So this is the kind of belief that we would ideally like to have in a philosophical theory. So we believe the theory in the sense that we adequately understand the theory and we have a high confidence that the theory is true. So it's only that sense of belief that I'm talking about. If by belief you mean a kind of mental state that we can have towards a proposition or a theory that we don't adequately understand, or if it only requires a fairly low degree of confidence, then maybe in that sense we can believe the error theory. But that's not the kind of belief that I'm talking about in the book. So that's the first thing I should say. And then the other thing is the thing you just mentioned. So I do think that there are various ways to come close to believing the error theory. And the two most important ones are, so first of all, one thing we can do is we can believe that the best arguments in metaethics seem to show that the error theory is true. Right. So as long as we don't believe that the arguments actually show this, we don't thereby, we're not saying anything that's insincere, right? So that is what I do believe about the arguments in metaethics. So I do believe that the best arguments seem to show that the error theory is true. And what prevents me from moving from there to the claim that the arguments actually show that the error theory is true is that I can't believe the error theory. But that's one way of coming close. And then the other way of coming close is that we can believe different parts of the error theory at different times while implicitly changing some of our other beliefs. So when I think about my arguments against realism, I can come to believe that normative properties don't exist. But I think that what's going on when I do that is that I implicitly change my background beliefs, and I form the background belief that a kind of implicit belief in the background that normative judgments don't actually ascribe those properties, but they're instead some other kind of state, maybe an attitude of approval or disapproval. And then I can also come to believe the other part of the error theory, so the part that says that normative judgments are mental states that represent the world and that ascribe properties to things in the world. And I do that by thinking about my arguments against non-cognitivism, but then I think that implicitly in the background, I am sort of assuming that the properties that those judgments ascribe do actually exist. So by going through the different arguments against the alternatives to the error theory, I can form a belief in a claim that is part of the error theory while in the background implicitly disbelieving the other part of the error theory. And I think, you know, that's a highly unusual way to come close to believing a theory, to, you know, believe different parts and at the same time implicitly disbelieve other parts. But I think that, you know, if I know that the reason why this is going on is that these things that I believe are part of an overall theory that I can't come to believe, if I know that this is why I'm cycling through the arguments in this way and forming these different beliefs in different parts of the error theory, then it's quite plausible to say that this is another way to come close to believing the error theory.
So, great. Let's remind our listeners that this book is a defense of the error theory.
Right.
That says that the error theory is not believable. I'm going to try to be as careful as I can in getting this thought right, because there are lots of ways to formulate it so that it's not right. Your view is that the unbelievability of the theory, and here's the tricky part, I don't know if I want to say counts in favor of the theory. We might say it's what the truth of the theory would predict or something like this, right? So we don't want to say that the unbelievability gives you a reason to think it's true because what the theory is.
Well, I don't believe the error theory myself either, so I can say that. And you can say it.
Well, let me put it this way. Can you run us through the thought that the unbelievability of the error theory is not a defeater of the theory, but is actually something that might be a feature of the theory or that might be that might count in favor of the theory? Can you run us through that thought?
Yeah, so the basic thought is that maybe the best way of putting it would be to say the unbelievability of the theory makes the theory more likely to be true, right? So that's not a normative claim, but it's just a claim that it makes it more likely to be true. And there are several ways in which it does that, I think. So one way in which the unbelievability of the error theory makes the theory more likely to be true is that it gives us a way to deal with certain central objections that philosophers have made to at least to moral error theories. And it makes a general normative error theory that's unbelievable more likely to be true because you can't really run those objections against this more general error theory. So one example would be what's known as the Morian, what's often called the Morian objection to the error theory, because it resembles G.E. Moore's argument against skepticism about the external world. Mm-hmm. So this objection says that the error theory entails certain claims that are just really, really hard to accept. So, for example, the error theory – I mean, obviously, the error theory entails that all normative judgments are false, and so it seems that claims that deny that something has a normative property should be true. So it seems that the error theory entails that torturing people for fun is not wrong, right? Because that just denies that torturing people for fun has the property of being wrong. But then the objection says, or the Morian objection says, well, look, our confidence in the claim that torturing people for fun is wrong is just much higher than our confidence in the truth of the error theory. And I can certainly say my confidence that it is wrong to torture people for fun is really much, much higher than my confidence in the truth of the error theory. But then the objection says, well, that shows that we should just reject the error theory and continue to believe that torturing people for fun is wrong, right? So you draw out this really hard to accept implication of the error theory, and you say, well, look, our confidence in the negation of that that implication is very, very high and is always going to be much higher than our confidence in the truth of the error theory, and that shows that we should just reject the error theory. So that's one prominent objection to the error theory, and there are different ways to deal with the objection, but I do think that if we cannot believe the error theory, then we can just say that the reason why, the explanation of why our confidence in the claim that torturing people for fun is much higher than our confidence in the error theory is just that we cannot believe the error theory, and so our confidence in the error theory is always going to be very, very low. But that, of course, doesn't show that the error theory is false. So it just shows something about us and about our inability to believe the error theory rather than showing that there is anything wrong with the theory itself. So that's one objection. Another objection that people often make is the objection from bad faith. So we talked earlier about how people who endorse a moral error theory often don't stop making moral judgments. And it's certainly true that philosophers who defend an error theory about all normative judgments don't give up all of these normative judgments. So instead, what they do is that they just continue to make normative judgments just like the rest of us. And the objection says, well, look, that's a form of bad faith. If you really want to defend the error theory, then you should be consistent and you should just give up all of your normative judgments. And then the reply to that objection, if we can't believe the error theory, could be, well, look, you know, we can't. No one can believe the error theory. So even people who defend the error theory can't believe the theory. And that enables them to hold on to their normative judgments without thereby being in bad faith. So I think, I mean, a general feature of what's going on here, I think, is that these objections to the error, I mean, not all of them, but a lot of objections to the error theory start from the idea of what you would have to do in order to really believe the theory, or what it would be like, or what you'd be committed to if you really believed the error theory. And those objections are not objections to the theory itself. And if the defender of the theory can't believe the theory, then they're not even objections that show that there's anything really wrong with somebody who defends the error theory without believing it.
And I take it that it's also that part of what the error theory would part of what the truth of the error theory would mean is its unbelievability, right? That it's almost a kind of indirect evidence. So our inability to fully form a full belief of the error theory is what the error theory would result in were it true.
Yeah. So it enables me to give a nice explanation of why no one is going to be convinced by the arguments that I give in the book. And that's because no one, including me, right? I don't believe the error theory. I can't believe the error theory, and none of my readers are going to be able to believe the error theory. So that explains why people are probably going to underestimate the plausibility of the arguments, including me, right? So when I consider the arguments separately, I can be convinced by them, but I can't be convinced by all of them at the same time. And I think another thing that we can sort of nicely explain if the error theory is unbelievable is we can explain why this debate in metaethics has gone on for such a long time without actually reaching a consensus. And that's because we're circling around this truth that none of us can really, really believe.
One last thing on this, and then we'll wrap up. You draw an analogy between the error theory as an unbelievable theory with some other views in philosophy that you suspect might also be unbelievable, like,
yeah,
say, certain forms in philosophy, certain eliminativist views in philosophy,
yeah,
of mind, for example. Can you just,
yeah,
spell out that analogy a little bit? I thought it was really interesting.
So it works differently in different cases, but my general thought was just that saying that a view is literally unbelievable is sort of a new way to defend the view. At least it's a new thing that we can say that might help to defend the view by diffusing certain objections or predicting that no one is going to be convinced by your arguments, even though they're good arguments. And so my thought was that there are certain other views in philosophy that are at least clearly very hard to believe, and then defenders of those views might say, well, actually those views are impossible to believe in a way that doesn't reflect badly on the view itself. So the view itself might still be true, it's just that we can't believe it. So and I run through several objections, several examples of views that can perhaps, I mean, I don't really commit myself to it, but yeah, that can perhaps be defended in this way. So skepticism about responsibility, where you say no one is responsible for anything, that might be the sort of thing that we can't really believe. Eliminativism about propositional attitudes, so the view that says beliefs and desires and intentions and so forth don't exist. So it seems that in order to believe that view, you would have to believe that you don't believe it. And that might be another thing that if you really think hard about it, maybe we can't do. But of course, that doesn't show that the view is actually false. So that's something that defenders of that view might use in order to make the view more plausible, show that the view is more likely to be true than it would otherwise be. And I think nihilism about truth, so the view that nothing is true, can perhaps also be partly defended in this sort of way. And there might be some other views as well that can be defended in this way. I mean, it's a general sort of move that I think maybe certain other views could make as well.
Right, against the backdrop of what I think is a pretty, I mean, a very solid meta-philosophical lesson, which is you know, it's very easy to lose sight of the distinction between the truth of a view and its believability.
Yeah, right.
And these two things are often conflated, and it's very, you can start seeing places where they're, once you see how, you know, how basic that distinction is, you start seeing the conflation all over the place.
Well, philosophers often say that's hard to believe.
Right? Yeah.
And then they mean that's false. But those are, and obviously, I mean, it's a way of speaking. So normally it's not a problem, but it's important to be aware of how different those two things can be.
Right. So, Bart Strummer, you've been very generous with your time. We've got only a few minutes left. So you've written a book in defense of a view that you yourself don't believe, because the view is that you can't be believed. What's your next project?
Well, I guess what I'm working on now is some papers that extend certain themes and arguments from the book. Maybe I'd like to do something that extends it to other areas of philosophy. And another thing I'd like to do is maybe return to political philosophy after this. So I'm kind of interested in whether it's possible to defend a Rawlsian version of liberalism by appealing to certain forms of skepticism, or maybe even to the error theory. So Brian Barry tried to defend Rawlsian liberalism by appealing to skepticism about value. And I guess the consensus view is that just doesn't work, because any kind of skepticism about people's conceptions of the good or about value are just also going to affect liberalism itself.
Right.
And I agree that on the face of it, it doesn't work. But that's something I'd like to think more about. I do think that a certain kind of skepticism about value can perhaps go together with a certain kind of liberalism. And maybe the unbelievability of the error theory or of certain forms of skepticism could also help to defend liberalism in that sort of way. Though I should say I'm not at all sure about this. That's just something that I'm thinking about right now, how that might perhaps be done.
Well, Bart, I just want to say, just imparting, the Unbelievable Error is a fabulous, fantastic book. I had a wonderful, wonderful time reading it, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's listening to the podcast. I want to thank you for your time, and I'll keep an eye out for future things by you, and I'll keep an eye on the journals for some of the reactions to the book. I take it that there's probably reviews and other kinds of pushback in the works from the metaethics community. Am I right?
Yeah. No, I hope so. I mean, that's part of philosophy. That's good.
That'll be wonderful. I'll keep an eye out for that. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. And thank you, listener. For listening to the podcast. Again, the book under discussion is written by Bart Strummer. The book is titled Unbelievable Errors, and it's published with Oxford University Press. Thanks for tuning into the podcast, and bye for now.